see the sign. Hey. I see the sign. Hey. I see the sign.
Hey, Lord, time draw nigh.
This sign of the judgment.
Hey.
This sign of the judgment.
Hey.
This sign of the judgment.
Hey, Lord, time draw nigh.
Sign in the fig tree.
Hey.
Sign in the fig tree.
Hey.
Sign in the fig tree.
Hey, Lord, time draw nigh.
Loose horse in the valley.
Hey.
Loose horse in the valley.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to a special episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, my two partners. We got Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, Brian and Nick.
And as Danny said, Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Well, hello.
Was that your shoddy attempt at a southern drawl?
I'm just sitting here thinking about space and time.
You're terrible at this. That is Nick's attempt to let the people at home know exactly how hard it is to affect a southern drawl as convincing and deep as Matthew McConaughey's, in case anyone was wondering how much of that was actual acting prowess. Thank you, Nick, for giving us that little demonstration. So today on the show, because nothing really came out this weekend that we wanted to talk about, and because the Grand Budapest Hotel doesn't come to DC for another week, thank you, we're going to be talking about the television show that set the internet on fire and shut down HBO Go, and it's something we talked about briefly before, and that is True Detective, the 8-episode series that just finished airing on HBO. Written by Nick Pizzolatto, directed by Cary Fukunaga, and starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. This whole episode will be laden with spoilers. We couldn't really think of a way to split off into a spoiler section, because it's 8 episodes, so, like, you know, would we have to do it by episode? That sounds crazy. Would we stop before, like, the 7th episode? Because that's also a little crazy. So, screw it. We're just taking a whole approach to it. Time is a flat circle. You've already seen the entire show, hopefully. And so, yeah, we're just going to go into it. So, if you haven't finished watching True Detective, don't listen to this. Get out there, finish it, and then come back. In the meantime, I'd like to also thank everyone who's given us reviews on iTunes. Please continue to do so. If you have not, go there, give us a comment, give us a rating, let us know how we're doing. You can also leave comments and ratings. Well, no, you can't leave ratings. You can also leave comments on the page for this episode at thefilmstage.com, and you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So that being said, no discussion this week. Let's just get right into True Detective. This is a show that kind of crept up. People were excited for it. And then the more people were watching it, the more people were really excited about it. Its popularity grew exponentially to the point where it literally took down HBO Go the night that it aired. So let's get into it. We already gave our brief thoughts on the first couple of episodes, but let's revisit that a little bit. So we'll begin by saying what we thought about the show starting off. And then, in keeping with some of the chatter on the internet, did you think that the show lived up to those first few episodes? Did you think that it continued to get better? Did you think it maintained? Or do you think, as some people do, that the quality of the show began to falter towards the end? So, Danny King, why don't you start us off?
Yes, with pleasure. I think back when we first talked about it, I had only seen the pilot, and I was impressed by it, but, you know, just got busy or whatever and didn't continue watching it. So I actually watched, like, every other episode this weekend. So, like, what, 7 episodes in, like, 2 days. So kind of went a little crazy just being stuck in that world for that continuous of a time period. I'm not sure if I'm out of it yet. But I think overall I like the series, although I do think, I don't know if it's so much that the quality got worse as it went along, or just that kind of problems that were there initially maybe kept coming back and being repeated and sort of wore on me as it went along. I think in general, it falls into this trap for me, and this is especially apparent in the finale where it's kind of going for this redemptive ending where I feel like it's glorifying these two main characters who are actually like really bad people. And I think we see that throughout the series that their behavior is not admirable and they're not really like moral people. And I think the sort of redemptive ending that Pizzolatto is going for is like problematic for me. I like his impulse in trying to like inject some hope into this series that is like largely very, very dark. But like at a certain point, I think you have to like be true to what you created, and the world he created here is not one where like Rust Cole comes out of that hospital room and thinks like everything is going to be okay. I think the more like the truer character moment there is when Woody Harrelson kind of breaks down in the hospital room, which is kind of like the Captain Phillips ending, where it's just like you come out of that demon lair or whatever and you're just not going to be okay. And I think that's maybe like where I wanted the show to go. And it kind of did this tacked on ending that I didn't really buy. I think also in terms of like the villain storyline, I mean, because that final episode, and this speaks to like general problems I have with just the structure of television, but like the final episode, basically everything that happens in it has like finale in quotes around it, because the structure of it doesn't justify like 60 minutes at all. I mean, the first 10 minutes, whatever, is just sort of like tease footage of the villain that's like really kind of reprehensible. And then there's an arbitrary clue that leads them to the final showdown, and then that's dragged on forever. And then we get the sort of like vindication at the end. So like, I guess you could say it ended on a sour note for me in terms of how I reacted to it. But I mean, still in terms of like other shows I've watched, this is like working in a more cinematic register, and I can appreciate that. And I think that, you know, we could talk about the performances later on, but I do think that the show is really well cast, not only in the two leads, but also a lot of the character actors that are chosen for the supporting roles are really quite good. So, yeah, True Detective.
All right.
Interesting show.
All right, Nick Newman.
Okay, so yeah, we had not talked about this show since the pilot aired, and it feels like the show really kind of grew in some very unexpected ways in the time since, and it got everyone's attention because there was this very long dolly shot, which is something like 6 minutes long, that became the talk of the town, and or just other such matters that kind of clouded the show itself, but it's funny, I kind of, you know, when we talked about the pilot, I had said how I liked everything in this show. I thought everything in the show was great except for the narrative itself, sort of the case at hand. And I don't think that ever really changed for me, sort of my general kind of disinterest in the case itself. And I will say that the seventh episode, I was watching it and I honestly thought it was not just the nadir of the series, but kind of just a disaster in itself. And I was thinking, oh, crap, this show has completely lost control of itself. And so this is where the case ends up. It's a very familiar area. But then I found that the eighth episode, the finale, kind of took that and sort of blew it up from the inside in a way that I found very fascinating and sort of redeemed that narrative direction. So throughout, I was always kind of, the case was always secondary to me. It was mostly about Harrelson and McConaughey sort of back and forth and their clashing personalities and sort of their own demons that they have to handle. That to me was always It was always compelling, if not a bit shallow, I think. I had kind of a hard time, with a few exceptions, I had a hard time taking the show completely seriously because it was so dour.
Yeah.
And it was just so serious. You know, you have the shot where McConaughey is waking up and he's scruffling his hair and it's shallow focus and you have a cross on the wall for some reason. Or you have the dolly shots, which last like 6 minutes and it's really hardcore. it felt an impressive technical feat, but it also felt very ostentatious too. Definitely taking from the Children of Men mold. I mean, absolutely. There are several points in that scene that are taking directly from the famous tracking shot in Children of Men, or dolly shot, however you want to call it. It's weird. To me, it was kind of a show, I think, of bits and pieces, really, with usually very good bits and very strong pieces. I'm not 100% sure how much it cohered ultimately, but I did like it a lot. And I think that perhaps my appreciation for it extends more to it as an experiment than an entirely complete work, because I really do appreciate this narrative having ended. That's it. And that's where, you know, they found the killer who did the antler business. And, that's kind of the end of it. And it's nice. It's not like The Killing or something where it's, you know, now there's a new case that they have to crack. Or it actually didn't also did not suffer from what crippled Twin Peaks, which was, of course, ABC wanted an answer to who killed Laura Palmer, so they gave it, and then they had nowhere to go. This ended when it needed to end. And it's funny, Danny said he didn't like the ending of the series. I found the final scene between McConaughey and Harrelson actually quite moving in a way I didn't expect. I think it was sort of just the culmination of watching this character, Rust Cole, played by McConaughey, over the course of 8 hours and however many weeks, I guess like 9 weeks in total, and just sort of his final scene I actually found very affecting and strangely plausible. Because the character itself was such a mystery to me, and I feel like the show did a fine job of building up these two men, who Danny says they're not good, but I mean, I think there's, I don't know, I think I kind of have sympathy for them, at least. I think it did enough to bring that to us. And, there's also talk of this as the most cinematic series that's aired on television in some time, and yes, I could see that. I'm not really a big fan of labeling things cinematic or not cinematic, but I do think that this definitely has sort of a much more aesthetically pleasing feel than most of what I'm seeing on TV. Even a lot of what you see on HBO, really. Even among that crop, I think it kind of stood out. I generally enjoy Game of Thrones, but it is kind of a visually repetitive show, and I don't know if there's much visual imagination there, really, past sort of capturing the sets themselves. It was good to see that. And then another show I like, I like Girls, but that's not really a director's show, per se.
Yeah.
To see this on television was exciting. I have this thing where I don't really, I'm kind of, if I watch like a TV show, I kind of feel bad because I could spend the time watching a movie. I never got that sensation watching this, which is actually no joke. That is a very high compliment that I can pay any TV show where I don't feel like it's guilt.
And like a lot of that might actually come from the fact that you knew that there was an ending point.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I didn't feel like, this is not like watching The West Wing on Netflix and there are like 7 seasons or something. This is 8 hours.
You can stop watching after the fourth.
Yeah, as I've been told many times over. Ultimately, this was, I think, a very strong piece of work. And, I'm curious to see where the second season goes. I definitely think there's room for improvement. And it actually hasn't been renewed, which I find weird, because I feel like it's been the biggest thing HBO's had in some time.
Yeah, I guess outside of something like Game of Thrones, maybe, like, this is the one that's gotten them the most chatter.
Yeah, it seems like it.
And, I don't see people crashing HBO Go for the Girls finale, so...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, no, I thought that the quality of the show basically held itself at a high note for the entirety of its run. I will say that the seventh episode, which kind of acted as an interstitial sort of denouement between the bulk of the series and then getting them to the end, was a lower point, but also that's because it abandoned a lot of the framing device that had held it in the first place. So, yeah, talking about the ending, a lot of people that I work with especially, had this kind of obsession with, and I'm sure, you know, anyone who's listening to this has probably paid attention to all this, you know, talking about like, oh, Five Men, or ooh, the Black Stars, or oh, if you have read this, you might know about this, and that could go into this, and like, there seemed to be this assumption that the final episode was going to be some paradigm-shifting twist that would reframe everything that we'd seen, and, you know, the good would become evil, and evil people would become more evil, and then, you know, a giant fish monster would come out of the bayou and eat everyone. Like, that seemed to be what people were going for. And I actually had to talk back against a lot of that, especially when people were doing things like reading into the fact that the poster had split like a, I guess, an old bad photo negative. And people were like, his yellow hair is at the bottom of the poster. That's his crown and he's the Yellow King. And it's just like, wow, really? Christ, guys. So coming off of the finale, there seemed to be a lot of almost post-traumatic stress. Like, people who had been so feverishly cataloging all these things were kind of having a that's it moment. And I feel like that's more on them than it's on the television show, because the show, I don't think, ever really lived in the narrative that they were spilling for themselves. Like, it never really came down to some background thing that other people had discovered. And I liked that about it. I liked the kind of straightforward nature. I liked the operatic sense that it was giving to itself. We've already said it was beautiful. Obviously, it was beautiful. It was intelligently written and well acted. And yeah, I found that the end, to be as simple as it was, helped to... And this is something that I'd said about the show for a while, that some of the more out there elements helped to kind of grant a universality to what is otherwise a very honed down personal story about these two men. So I love the show. It's one of the best, most complete shows that I've seen in a while. And I loved Breaking Bad, don't get me wrong. And that was also a beautiful, interesting show. But this, I think, just through the sheer dint of its brevity... It was here for a mere fleeting 8 episodes. And the way that it was acted and the way that it was conceived and executed had a kind of completeness to it that is rare and that I really quite enjoyed. One of the things that I had wanted to talk about here, actually, was this concept. Because a couple of weeks ago, on Valentine's Day weekend, actually, we got the newest season of House of Cards. And all the same people who were kind of, you know, week in and week out talking about True Detective and were kind of let down by its finale just because of the simplicity of its story, a simplicity that I think helped to serve the greater message and service the theme of, you know, people finding their place within the universe and within society and, you know, the nature of good versus evil and the incompleteness of the battle therein. I mean, like, people were really enjoying House of Cards, and it came out all at once. So for one weekend, you couldn't get away from it. Meanwhile, True Detective aired over the course of, I think, 9 weekends because it had a break in the middle for the Super Bowl. Which do you think is the better way to release something? Because we had talked about House of Cards when the first season came out. So is that kind of upfront rush a good thing or a bad thing in terms of delivery? Like, if House of Cards were released in the same way True Detective was, do you think it would maintain the kind of freight train-esque momentum that True Detective was able to achieve?
Probably not.
Is there a particular reason for that?
I think it's. I don't see this as a negative reflection on House of Cards necessarily. I have not seen the second season, but I think it's more just the way the shows are written, where that's kind of, they say it's written with Netflix in mind. It's written with the mindset that you can binge them, you can watch them all in a very close set, space of time. And I think it's funny because True Detective, I actually said after I watched the finale, I tweeted just quickly that I feel like the show kind of inadvertently wound up commenting on its own audience in a way, because there were all these theories and there was a thing about like, oh, the yellow crown on Woody Harrelson's head or something. And what I said was that basically the whole Yellow King thing turned out to kind of be nothing. I said it was just like, it was this ugly hick who was kind of, you know, using his own, he was sort of inheriting this financial destitution, and he kind of was using that as sort of a pathway for something else that he had been passed down, which was this hatred. And that's kind of all it was. It was just this guy who fancied himself some kind of cult leader, but he was some weirdo, basically. And what I had also said was that I feel like the show kind of is ultimately kind of about sort of exercising sort of this kind of like this evil in that culture, particularly I think in sort of a Louisiana culture, sort of their obsessiveness with these dark mystical elements. But I think the show positions it all as phooey, essentially. It says that, you know, this is kind of a pathology that people they're not born with, they more adopt it or it's passed down to them. Because it seems like it could explain why things are the way they are. But as Rust Cole says, that's just sort of life itself. And so there's kind of an interesting, I think there's an interesting collision there between sort of the central character's ideology and the antagonist's ideology, and how one comes out on top of the other. Good comes out on top of bad, but not necessarily in the way you would expect. Mm-hmm. And maybe not necessarily the way Rust Cole himself would expect, where he was sort of correct, but he and Marty also kind of got on top because of pure strength, and intellect almost had little to do with it in a way. Because you think about the Yellow King, who doesn't seem like he's very intelligent necessarily.
He depends more on malaise to keep his identity safe than anything else.
Right, and ultimately it came down to who could get their gun out and shoot him in the head. As so much of life does, yes. And so it's fascinating to kind of chart how kind of these ideologies are clashing with each other. And although I said I have trouble taking the show seriously, I do think it has a brain and its head. I do. I just think that tonally it could kind of lose itself sometimes. Although I do think the show is very funny.
Oh, God, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, actually, I think this is why I really didn't like the seventh episode, because it kind of dispensed with that, and it just sort of became another procedural, or another very dark procedural. And, you know, also, not only that, but I also found sort of the handling of time kind of clunky, where even though we had been watching them separated for like 6 hours, when they do come together, it feels sort of anticlimactic, as someone who is sort of a devotee of the David Chase method, which is to accept that most things in life are anticlimactic, as much as to sort of speak of HBO and I guess his excellent film Not Fade Away, I also do think to myself, something about that, it just sort of kind of happened. And once they're together, it kind of just became another show. And yet something about the conclusion to me was more satisfying. The way it came to a head, I thought, was actually quite nice. And again, this is why I say I like the idea of it a bit more than I like the actual execution. And I do think there is room for improvement in the second season. But if this is kind of not necessarily a test run, but if this is a first run of the True Detective model, then I really can't wait to see where the second season goes.
Yeah,
maybe
absolutely.
Lighten up a bit.
Well, the reason I had asked about the whole Netflix House of Cards thing is that today there were so many articles written all across the internet. I can think of a couple off the top of my head, like The Atlantic and Slate.com. And I mean, oh God, too many to mention. But those are the ones that stuck out most to me. And they were kind of questioning a lot of the stuff that had been brought up in the series as kind of like, I guess, thoughtful exercises or things that you could dwell on and find a place for, but that were never explicitly handed to you. Things such as the Tuttles and their relationship to the grander occult mystery. Things like Marty's daughter and her erratic behavior. And they were all kind of annoyed that those things weren't more deeply tied into it. And it's because we had these weeks between each episode to kind of take everything new that we'd learned, compound it, and try to fit it into this assumption that we had about the show. Whereas, if you ever, Nick, get around to watching the second season of House of Cards, I defy you to tell me what the fuck was going on for most of that. Because it is some of the most labyrinthine in a bad way, like staggeringly complex in a bad way, backroom dealing nonsense that I've ever seen. And no one seemed to care about that because you watch it in a kind of fugue state, where you're not even taking in the words so much as you're taking in the way that people are reacting to a situation.
So or Kevin Spacey's grins at the camera.
Yeah. So like if you hear a 20-minute conversation about a bridge in Williamsburg and trade tariffs on some kind of obscure metal against the Chinese, you're just kind of like nodding your head like, okay, okay, okay. And then when something finally happens and Kevin Spacey's either, you know, vaguely pleased, which I think is the best that we can say for Frank Underwood on a good day, or viciously angry, that's what you're responding to. You're like, oh, okay, Frank got what he wanted. Oh, Frank didn't get what he wanted. So now you're just living in that world. And when that ended, everyone was kind of like, oh yeah, that was really good. But if you ask them why, it kind of falls apart. It's almost like you're drunk and you're at a really great party, and your mind just kind of edits and says, you were dancing at some point. There was good music on at some point. The drinks were fine. And you forget about the fist fight you got in and the fact that you were bored in the middle for like half an hour because you can't really consolidate all of this bizarre information that you've been given. So when you wake up with a hangover the next day and your ears are ringing, you're just like, yeah, it was fun. And I think that that's something that the written for Netflix does. It allows it to just kind of burn through you. I think that if we had been given the time to watch it in the way that we had been given the time to watch True Detective, it would fare a lot worse. At the same time, I think that if we were allowed to watch True Detective in the way that we watch House of Cards, I think it might have been better because it wouldn't have given certain factions of the internet the time to both comb over it so intently and also write about it to such length and then take all those other writings and consolidate them further. It's a weird dissonance because True Detective is definitely a show that invites a lot of speculation and has a lot of little things in the background that you can pull in to examine its worldview. And I think everyone went about it the completely wrong way. Every time you saw black stars on something, instead of just saying that black stars could be a symbol of overarching evil or unrest in the universe, people immediately said it has to be part of the cult. Anytime that you saw a rich white man, he had to be part of the cult. And there wasn't really a lot in the show to support that theory. But people made it so. And I don't know how we came to this point as a movie and television viewing populace. But I think it's dangerous, and I think we need to stop. Because there are so many people today in my office and on the internet who said, you know, if we had found out that Maggie or her father had been complicit in this, and if we had found out that Marty's daughter had been abused in some way, it would have been so much more blank, so much more interesting, so much more emotional, so much more compelling. But to me, I think it actually would have destroyed it a little bit. Because one of the things that makes these two men the true detectives of the title is that they are just doing their job. And they're doing it now outside of the strictures of the law because it's right. Not because they have a personal stake in it, but because no one else is willing to take a personal stake in it. And so just on a purely moral stand front, or, you know, home front, they take it. And that's where the power comes from. And that's what makes Rust Cole's eventual turn at the end of the series towards a vague degree of optimism all the more powerful. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I would, no, I mean, I don't necessarily disagree. I guess I just, I guess I kind of wonder how, it was weird because I was thinking, like, am I not watching this show correctly when I'm not thinking about it that much? Like, I'm kind of, I'm sort of, you know, enjoying it and I'm relatively engaged with the narrative for at least the characters, and yet I'm not noticing, like, there was a thing where one of the spirals was like a drawing that Marty's daughter had made and it was on the wall.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought maybe it's just an Easter egg. Like maybe it's
not. Well, that's my thing. Like I would see these things and it's like, you know, people, I was telling someone this today that the cult wasn't the source of every evil in the world. And so a lot of, and, or the unrest or unhappiness in the world. And so a lot of these could just be symbols that are used to say, like, this is part of the greater societal malaise we're dealing with, or this is part of the greater, you know, human frailty that we're dealing with. But a lot of people weren't able to look at it that way.
Yeah.
Like that spiral on the wall and every instance of black stars.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. But I think that that's where a lot of the disappointment came from. Because when I wasn't immune to it. I talked about theories like a motherfucker. I thought that Rust Cole was going to kill himself at the end.
Right, and instead you got the ending of Silence of the Lambs. Which is exactly what I thought of, and that was kind of... That was sort of strange.
A little bit. But I mean, like, there were parts of me that were like, I'm sure that his daughter's going to be part of it, I'm sure that this... But I tempered that by saying, but I've had such a good time with the show that I'm not going to allow myself to believe that I have conceived of a better ending than its author has.
I mean, maybe it's just because I don't really watch that much TV nowadays, but I don't really, I never really thought of how this show would end. I just kind of went with it. I never really thought, you know, I didn't imagine some final scene, some amazing final climax for these people. I kind of just thought, oh, well, let's see what they get into this week, I guess. It was never that way for me. I don't know if Danny feels the same way or...
Well, I think that, like, when we're looking at the sort of overreading that's been doing, we have to consider, like, how this show is pitched in a way. So, like, if you go back to the pilot, the main event of that pilot is them finding this body with, like, antlers in it. And it's like, what the fuck is going on? So you could see where people tune in for that pilot and see, like, okay, I wonder what this show is going to be. And they see a body with antlers attached to it. And they're like, okay, I'm going to stick around to see, like, what the fuck is, like, making this or how this is happening. So I feel like, you know, whereas you and, like, me and maybe Brian, too, weren't necessarily watching this to expect, like, this grand climax. I feel like a lot of people might have been tuning in for exactly that reason. And I think that even... you know, the writer and the director are sort of catering to that, especially in the pilot where you kind of have like, I don't know, like 25 minutes of buildup of them just getting to the location. And you have like this reveal of like this bad guy who has this just palace of like sadism. And it's like kind of ridiculous, but it's almost like a genre convention. Like if you string people along for 7 episodes, you have to like give them that in like a really sort of disturbing way. I mean, there's just this idea where like each new serial killer story has to have like a more fucked up character than the last one, or else it's like not, you know, it doesn't live up to the bar. And I think one thing that this show did with the villain that I actually kind of liked, and we hinted at this earlier, but it was just this fact that him and like his wife sister woman, who's actually played by Anne Dowd, which is insane. She was
in Compliance, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So that's crazy. But just the fact that they're, like, mentally deficient, I thought was pretty, like, a smart move. Because, I mean, we have all these villains. I mean, like Hannibal Lecter or even, like, John Doe from Seven that are these, like, super intelligent people.
Yeah, but, the intelligent psychopath.
Yeah. But, I mean, when you look at, like, the video in True Detective, like, what kind of guy is going to put on a spaghetti mask and, like, rape girls? It's probably someone who's just not an intelligent human being.
And they even kind of allude to this fact, and I think a lot of people either missed this or thought that it was unsatisfying, but that he was part of this larger group that involved these church leaders and possibly this state senator.
Mm-hmm.
That has kind of, like, fallen apart. Like, it seems as though they stopped at some point, and he's just this weird, broken individual who had been a victim of them and who's kind of lashing out at all these people who did this to him and made him this way. Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, like, it's hard to imagine him in his state being a part of a system where, like, the other members are sort of similar.
Yeah.
Because he's so off the deep end that it's like, it's just really fucked up.
Yeah, and he even tried kind of growing his own little cult following, Reggie Ledoux and DeWalt, who got clipped in episode 5, I think.
Mm-hmm.
5 or 6, I cannot recall.
It was 5. That was actually, 5 is, might be the, it might, it's probably the most impressive episode of the series, the way that it really kind of crystallizes sort of the question of, or rather, I don't want to say crystallizes it, but definitely really makes provocative the question of understanding sort of one man's account versus another person's, and then another woman's account eventually, as we see in the
sixth episode. Yeah, the perspectives.
Yeah, that was really
good. That was good.
That was pretty fascinating, and part of me was, but I also kind of like the idea. I don't know if this is myself reading too much into it and kind of, you know, falling into this trap, but part of me likes to think that the whole 1995 narrative, sort of when it's running on that continuum, it's all kind of potentially, I don't know. I guess I'm kind of curious as to where there might be holes in that narrative. And part of me likes to think the show, it's strange because the episode makes such a point of it, and then I feel like the rest of the series doesn't. And I'm wondering if that is just sort of in the background of the show. That's kind of part of the show's DNA, and it's not something, it's an unspoken quality, albeit a very significant one at that. It's something I was kind of thinking about, and I'd be curious to go back to some other episodes and maybe notice any inconsistencies which exist there. Like, I kind of, you know, I wonder sort of, for instance, you know, the character of Matthew McConaughey's character has never really made sense to me, which I find very interesting.
Okay.
There's sort of like inconsistencies in his characterization. For instance, sort of the idea that he would have sex with Marty's wife to me doesn't really make sense.
Really?
He seems like, yeah, because he doesn't seem, or that he would just have a relationship at all, because he seems like he just would not be interested in any physical contact whatsoever.
Well, I think that a lot of his posturing against humanity all comes from this kind of pain that he's been carrying around about his daughter's death. And I think that a lot of it is, he wants all of those things, but he's kind of convinced himself that he doesn't need them or that they're pointless. And I think that he actually has been attracted to Marty's wife since he first met her. Because she's the one who he opens up to about his daughter and his marriage, and
there's that
great line where she says something along the lines of, you know, they've had a blind date set up for him, and, you know, she says, you know, you guys never give anything a chance. Why is that? And he says, we know what we want, and we don't mind being alone, which is pretty much perfect. I cannot agree more.
Right. I would say, I mean, I think it's part of why I like the last, well, it's the last scene, but the sort of the final big talk between Marty and Rust, why I like that so much, why I find it very moving, was because I guess although I found him to be so much of a mystery, I was it answered sort of questions about him. It sort of, to me, it was kind of cutting the Gordian knots in a way. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that expression.
No.
It's sort of the story of a king who there was this, I don't have to go into it too much, but there was this knot which even the finest hands in all the lands could not untie. So his solution was he finally just took a sword and just cut it. And this, to me, is kind of, in terms of characterization, it's kind of cutting the Gordian knot that is that character and just having him have this near-death experience and finally coming to terms with a number of things, which isn't to say he'll be normal necessarily,
right.
But it was an interesting way of bringing that about. It didn't feel like a cop-out to me, even though it was...
He's still got that mustache. No man with that mustache can ever be normal.
No, that's true, yeah. even though, as Danny said, it had like very much a finale air to it, I guess to me it did not. It felt at least somewhat plausible. That was a nice component of it.
Yeah, yeah. I really like that understated way. I like the fact that almost, this ending was nothing that anyone had predicted. And everyone's always talking about how they wanted like an unpredictable ending. And this was the only ending that I didn't see some permutation of on the internet. Like, no one said they're both going to live and Rust is going to find some kind of semblance of God in his life.
Right.
So, like, when people are talking about the need for something surprising and shocking and a twist, I mean, like, that's a huge twist because no one saw that coming. So I don't know what, the people don't want a twist. They want to be the smartest people in the room. They want to be the person who figured it out first. And oddly enough, and I think this is the most hilarious thing, Marty talks a number of times about the detective's curse. You know, the solution was right under my nose, but I was busy looking everywhere mm-hmm. else. And that's what the show did to people.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
It was one of its greatest accomplishments.
I like that it ultimately just kind of, at least somewhat, took place in the real world.
Yeah.
I'm still not sure about this. This is kind of more... a small, admittedly, part of the obsessive thing, but I can never really understand the shot where Cole sees, like, some kind of space tornado or something.
It's like a black hole.
Yeah, sure, or that. I couldn't really understand what was happening there.
He sees things. I don't know. That's one of those things I think I'll
actually
have to look back on. But
now I remember there's the part where he's, like, driving, and he's...
Yeah, and then he sees the birds as well later on.
Yeah, which was...
Yeah, I think that episode is called Seeing Things.
It is.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, he sees things.
And he sees them all the time. And, you know, it's rare that we're actually given the third-person superimposition of what he's seeing.
One thing also I want to say, I'm actually, right now, I'm looking at a piece by Matt Zoller Seitz called The Seven Things That True Detective Is About.
Yes.
And it's a really good piece.
I actually read that earlier. It is a very good piece.
Okay. And one thing he says, that's correct. One thing he says, which I did not think of, but he actually compares the conclusion to Apocalypse Now. And it kind of got me thinking about sort of the visual, the visual ensconcement of that scene, the blackness, and how it all seemed to be taking place in this, just this black pit.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of this very heightened feeling, which to me kind of was an example of kind of bringing the show, sort of reconciling the show's past and present timelines, because I found that the present section was a bit too... It felt very rote and kind of ordinary up to then, but then that kind of, to me, reconciled it and made it that strange metaphysical place that we were experiencing. And I guess it's funny because it kind of makes me think, you know, how much of the credit goes to Fukunaga and how much of it goes to Nick Pizzolatto, the creator and writer. It was, I guess maybe that's a sign of a strong television collaboration, at least, because we've never really had much like this.
No.
There was Top of the Lake, which I haven't seen.
I haven't seen that either.
Same cinematographer.
Really?
Was it really? Okay.
Yeah, he's a talented guy. And like they have, it's funny because those are like the most kind of two recent TV things I've watched, and they're both these like gray, kind of depressing crime thrillers. So like I need a break or something.
Mm. Okay.
Well, I don't know what to recommend to you. TV wise,
yeah. Watch. Yeah, I was gonna say, Nick, are you even watching any other TV shows?
I mean, not at this moment. I mean, there's Girls, but that's like half an hour.
Girls.
It's a great show. It's at its best right now.
I'll take you for it.
I mean, I watch Mad Men, but that's not on right now.
It's not on right now. No.
And I watch Boardwalk Empire, and that's not on right now. And this is gonna be the final season.
And then I watch True Detective, and that's not on right now.
Yeah. So right now it's just half an hour a week, and it's.
I'm watching a few things actually, and I'm gonna make those my recommendations at the end.
Okay.
So we'll hold on to that. Any final thoughts about True Detective before we wrap it up?
Just in terms of some of the other supporting actors, I think we have to give a shout out to Shea Whigham.
Shea Whigham.
Continues to be in every piece of visual storytelling ever made.
I actually love his scene as the revival tent preacher.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I would go watch that preacher.
And I would watch Shea Whigham.
You don't even hear enough of what he's preaching about to really get it. But just because of his cadence and his commitment, I'm like, I'd probably watch that preacher.
You know, it's weird. I went to this presentation on Thursday about something called expanded cinema, which is this very experimental, sort of very outside the bounds form of filmmaking. And they showed a few examples of it, or what exists of these few examples. And Shea Whigham was in all of them. So
he was what? Weird.
I said Shea Whigham was in all of them, all of these videos. So,
are you serious?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm not. No, he's not actually in everything. But
he's the future of cinema.
If just like these like really, you know, these really little scene museum displays had Shea Whigham just like as a model or something.
Goddamn anyway. Shea Whigham. I will also say that I liked Michelle Monaghan's work in this.
Yeah,
even though,
good.
Even though apparently this is the most misogynist show in the history of television.
Yeah, I kind of
think it is a little bit though.
I think that it is that the misogyny is informed by the worldview of the characters.
Sure,
right, but like, it's also like in the camera a little bit and just like very HBO like sex scene.
Well, there's only one sex scene that even comes close to being the worst. Or even in like the top tier of the most lurid things that HBO has shown.
Well, I read an interesting interview with Pizzolatto where he said that he actually like HBO like really want that. Like they actually kind of say like you have to you got to have this here.
Yeah, like hey man, we can show tits. You should put some tits in this.
So maybe it's a you know player versus game situation we have going on here.
Yeah, there was something like that about Game of Thrones too, where like one of the directors was interviewed and he's like, yeah, you know, there's like a producer on set who's just like, you know, you could have a naked chick here.
Who I wonder what that guy looks like who just walks around like pointing at different spaces, like you can have a naked woman here.
I bet he's like an accountant and he's just got a calculator out and he's like, you know, we've shot like 6,000 feet of footage. Really gotta point this out to you. You need at least 500 feet of naked people now.
Yeah, I will say that the whole, I mean, yes, it is true that the show kind of, the show does kind of, it takes that worldview, but I feel like for me personally, I feel like the Wolf of Wall Street kind of broke that for me finally, sort of that as a defense in a way. Because that to me was like sort of the most egregious version of that possible, short of like a show about like a just an actual rapist or something. short of that, that to me was like the furthest you could really go with it nowadays. And so after that, granted, True Detective was not, it was not like they saw The Wolf of Wall Street and decided to take after that. This was just sort of a matter of timing. But I feel like maybe let's kind of, you know, unless this is like, you know, a great work of literature or something that's going to really put us in the character's head, let's give it a, you know, let's give it like 3 years before we return to the mind of the misogynistic man. Because it's like, It's interesting, but we have the ground's covered. That ground's covered. So let's try something else. Maybe it seems like True Detective Season 2 might actually be about female detectives, which...
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently the secret cult history of transportation in the United States.
Yeah.
What the fuck does that mean?
Has that seriously been talked about?
Yeah. That is literally what the creator said.
Wow.
So I'm excited.
Okay.
Who knows?
One other actor really quick. Michael Potts, who plays one of the interviewers... He, made a lot of the jokes in the series for me because his, default face in the performance is, a smile.
Yeah.
So every time, McConaughey gives one of his, speeches where he's, dragging on his cigarette forever and, just taking really long to talk, and then it just cuts to Michael Potts, and he looks like he's actually smiling. And so it made those scenes even funnier because, within the reality of the scene, it's a serious interview. Why would he be laughing? And the other guy's not laughing.
Yeah, the other guy is...
He's pretty serious. So it's solid. Just this actor's default face is all right, Matthew McConaughey, I know what you're doing. This is this is pretty funny.
Something I found out that blew my mind, that actor, Michael Potts, do you know what his most prominent prior role was?
No.
He was Brother Muzone on The Wire.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Did either of you watch The Wire?
I haven't watched The Wire, no.
I don't think I've seen that part of The Wire. I'm only on
season 2. Oh, okay. Well, if you've seen... Oh, yeah, I think that's season 3. If you've seen The Wire, you'll remember that character. And I just, listeners might...
I'm assuming he's Nation of Islam.
Yes. Well, sort of. It's not really explained. It's a very strange character. Okay. That was something that I found that out and my mind was blown because I thought he looked vaguely familiar, but I thought he was just some actor, just one of those guys, character actors. And then it turns out, Brother Muzone. So yes.
All right. Well, that's our review of True Detective. Let us know what you thought of True Detective. You can comment on the page for this podcast on thefilmstage.com under features. Or you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. So let's quickly burn through what's coming out in the next week, and then we can go. You can get out of your way. So, coming to Blu-ray and DVD, we have Inside Llewyn Davis, Out of the Furnace, Homefront, The Book Thief, and a couple of reissues of stuff, it looks like. So any of these lighting your world on fire, guys?
Well, I know Llewyn Davis was Danny's favorite movie last year, so...
Yeah, no, I like that film quite a bit. I'm happy it's receiving the Blu-ray treatment. I thought it was kind of going to go just underground and, straight to VHS or something. But, if you're looking for a Woody Harrelson kind of... side dish, you could go with Out of the Furnace.
Yeah, Out of the Furnace, which I quite enjoyed. So,
there's a bunch of westerns or western-esque titles being re-released.
There are El Dorado, Gunfight of the OK Corral. Yeah,
two Howard Hawks movies I have not seen, El Dorado and Hitari. I'm excited to see those. It's good they're on Blu-ray. However, I do have a bone to pick. The Hitari Blu-ray cover is just John Wayne holding a rifle. But I love the Hitari poster and the DVD cover because if you Google Hitari poster, it looks like John Wayne is shouting the movie's title. I don't even know what Hitari means or what the significance of it is, but it looks like he's shouting that, and now that's gone. This release. Also, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia by Sam Peckinpah, which I've heard is...
Oh, I want to see that. Yeah.
I've heard is a wonderful movie. So I'd like to see that as well. Otherwise, a reissue of Devil, the elevator movie. A reissue of Cowboys and Aliens.
Ooh.
And there's also a Blu-ray double feature of The Butterfly Effect and The Butterfly Effect 2.
Ooh. Does it have a subtitle or is it just The Butterfly Effect 2?
I think it's just 2.
Damn it! There's also a Shutter Island and Aviator double feature, which is actually, a good one. And yes, Danny, The Book Thief. The Book Thief is coming out. Okay, so let's get away from this. Opening March 14th. Grand Budapest Hotel will be expanding. That's what we'll be talking about next week. Also coming out, Need for Speed. I'm gonna be honest. I'm actually looking forward to seeing this movie. I don't know why.
Really?
I don't know why. I'm not a car person. I don't particularly care about anything related to this film. But for some reason, I'm just like, yeah, I'll go see that. Every once in a while, you know, I'll take in a dumb movie. It might turn out to be this year's Dread, a movie that I went to with the worst kind of trepidation, and came out of loving. We also have the Veronica Mars movie,
yeah,
the little Kickstarter that could. You know, I liked the series. I don't think I'm going to go see it in theaters, but I've heard good things.
Did you watch like the whole show or?
Yeah.
Wow. I have never seen a second of it, so I really don't even know what the...
It's good. It's good. It's like, if you're into like noir detective fiction, it's good.
Right.
We also got Bad Words.
Enemy.
Yes, I'm getting to that, Danny. Bad Words,
the most important film of the year.
Directed and starring Jason Bateman. And Enemy, which I am looking forward to so, so much.
Yeah.
And that is also in limited release. Hopefully it comes to us because I want to talk about that movie, guys. I want to talk about it bad.
Same.
Excellent.
I mean, you remember Prisoners. That was some serious...
I enjoyed Prisoners.
Serious,
I
mean, cinema.
I'm not going to lie. I'm looking forward to the next Villeneuve.
Yeah, no, I liked Prisoners, as absurd as it was. But I've heard Enemy is much better.
Yeah,
I'm
looking forward to it like a son of a bitch. So that's that. Like I said, we'll be talking about the Grand Budapest Hotel. Look forward to that, everybody. Now let's do a 3-second little talk about what we've watched on our own that we think you all should check out at home. Nick Newman. I'm gonna say that I'm gonna do two, and they're both television shows. So if you have a television show that you'd like people to watch, maybe this is the time to do it, because we did talk about
no.
a television show this week.
No.
No, you're not even gonna make a case for Girls?
I haven't seen the last two episodes, so I can't speak to it.
Jeez.
I did last night I saw Nymphomaniac Volume 1. Great, especially when you watch it with a group of people. that's going to be one of my best film viewing experiences this year, is watching that with a group of people. Great, don't get me wrong, I bought it. Like, I didn't pirate it and then, like, you know.
Yeah, it's on VOD
just say,
right
screw
now.
Screw my noise. Like, yeah, like, I bought the film and I watched it with people, and that was a lot of fun. And the movie itself is good. I'm waiting to see part two. I have sort of a thing to say about it, but if part two turns out to be bad, then I'm going to have to eat my words. And, you know, I can only eat my words once a year. Last year it was To the Wonder, and what will it be this year? I don't know. Okay, I'm getting way off track. What am I going to go with?
Nymphomaniac.
I watched a lot of films over the weekend. I think the one I'll recommend... I'll go with Chafed Elbows, which I watched on Wednesday. It's a 1966 movie directed by Robert Downey Sr. I guess actually before he was even, I think maybe before he was even Robert Downey Sr. or at least before anybody knew, well, definitely before anybody knew who his son was. It's like a 58-minute comedy, an absurdist, surrealist comedy about this guy who was going through his annual mental breakdown. And a lot of the film is, narratively, there's not exactly much there. Like a lot of Downey Sr.'s films, it's made up of vignettes. But the film actually screened recently at Anthology Film Archives in New York City, for those who don't know that theater. It was part of a series dedicated to cinema that uses still photos prominently, because most of the film consists of still photos. And it's interesting, just kind of the way Downey Sr., who I think is quite a strong filmmaker, is able to kind of mine these situations from still photographs, and how he can kind of undercut them when he actually does get to moving images themselves. Which isn't to say it's a grand statement on cinema itself or anything. It is mostly a silly underground New York comedy from the mid to late 60s, but if that's your sort of thing, if that sounds appealing to you, this is going to really strike your fancy. busy. I watched it on a DVD. I have the Eclipse set, Up All Night with Robert Downey Sr., which is a great set. It features his most famous film, Putney Swope. I don't know if anybody here has seen that, but they're all on Hulu as well. So they're actually relatively easy to find. It's weird that Criterion, not that we shouldn't expect this of them, but it is weird that, you know, because of their efforts, like these films, one of which only existed on like one 16mm print, is now like available to stream on your computer, or you can buy it at Barnes & Noble. Awesome. It's very nice. I also just want to say quickly, Alain René died last week, so I watched his film Mon Oncle d'Amérique, which is My American Uncle, from 1980, also on Hulu Plus, not really available on home video much elsewhere, but it's also on YouTube with decent English subtitles. Great film. If you're a fan of René, which I think we all are, as we kind of discussed, give that a watch. So I'll just throw that out there, but that's my viewing.
All right, Danny King, what about yourself?
Well, I actually can stick with the TV theme.
Woo.
Because I had a sort of home viewing assignment for a class that was the 1976 TV movie Sybil.
God damn it. I was really hoping that, like, for once we'd have some, like, mainstream
stuff. Nah.
Nope, nothing. Okay, well, yes. Talk about Sybil.
course mandated viewing, and, you know, definitely not an antidote to True Detective or anything like that. It's an equally dark work about, you know, this girl who was abused when she was younger, and she's played by Sally Field in a pretty amazing performance, and she grew up to have dissociative identity disorder, so she has about like a dozen different personalities, and the about her sessions with the psychiatrist that cures her. And it's a really surprising film, like formally for a TV movie, because it really does kind of get into her head, and it's very disorienting at times. But it's also like very worthwhile if you can stomach the content. And yeah, that's my bid for TV.
All right, excellent. Well, I'm going to talk about two shows real quick that are both airing now and have just started, so you can hop on board with minimal effort. The first is NBC's Hannibal, which I believe I spoke about a little bit last year. This is when I found out that Nick Newman apparently hates Hugh Dancy.
Yeah, no, I watched the pilot, and I thought his performance was like one of the worst things I've ever seen. awful, awful, awful performance. And maybe it's because there are two very good Will Graham performances, two very different, very good Will Graham performances out there. I just thought the rest of the show, I watched the pilot and I hated it so much.
Weird.
And then what happened was, well, it's weird because then people I know whose taste I respect, multiple people have said that this is like a really great, entertaining show, but I just can't do it.
So am I a person you know or a person whose taste you respect?
I didn't know you were a fan of it, so I don't know.
It's a damn good television show. It's one of the most like sickeningly weirdly beautiful television shows on TV right now. And I think that all the actors are uniformly great, so I don't know particularly what your problem with Hugh Dancy's Will Graham is, but I'll disagree. For anyone who doesn't know, this is a kind of, you know, prequel to Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter / Red Dragon. And it examines a relationship that Will Graham had with Hannibal Lecter and that Hannibal Lecter had with the FBI before everyone knew that he was a murderous cannibal. It has a lot of fun playing with the idea that everyone on Earth that is watching the show knows what none of these characters do, which is that Hannibal is a psychopathic cannibal murderer. Which, you know, you should really be able to intuit just through his name. Because who on earth would ever trust someone whose name was Hannibal Lecter? I don't know, but these people do it. Good for them. It's a great show. Very eerie. It is insanely violent, but the violence is filmed and kind of treated in such a way that it's almost like high camp art. And it really works. It works to help tone down what would otherwise be an almost unwatchable show. So it's really good. Deserves attention. It's on Friday nights. I know that sucks, but DVR it or watch it the next day so we can get those plus one numbers up and keep this thing going. The other show that I've been watching. Oh, I'm sorry, Nick. What?
I was gonna say. I'm a big fan of. The Hannibal Lecter character, and so I kind of, you know, I love Mads Mikkelsen too. So I was very excited about it, and then I saw the. Just the pilot, and I just it was bad. Okay. That's all. So, but things people say it's good, and yet I can't. I don't know. It's just becoming a real like sort of emotional conflict for me. Obviously,
I was about.
What
to
do
say,
I do I, here?
There's a real crisis behind your voice. The other show I've been watching a lot, and that I loved the first season, and I'm glad it's back, is The Americans on FX. This is a show about two Russian spies who are living and having a life in America as a normal American couple. The first season dealt with the fact that their marriage was fake, that it was a sham, even though it had produced two children.
Is this like certified copy?
No, not in that same way. They had been put together by Moscow and shipped here to be kind of like sleeper cell behind-the-scenes spies, and they slowly actually fell in love. So the first season was about their marriage becoming real, even as the net kind of closed in on them. This new series, or season, is about the dangers that are closing in on them and the effect it's having on their also very real children. So it's a really great show. Again, it's a really good to look at. It's quite beautiful. It takes place in the 80s, obviously. And, yeah, the performances are all universally like top notch. Writing is very witty, very funny, and also very compelling. And it is on FX Wednesdays at 10 o'clock. So check it out. A lot of other people have written about what a damn good show this is. And it is one of the most entertaining and yet thoughtful, intelligent shows that I've seen in quite some time. So do that. That's your cinematic selections for the boob tube. So that's it. We're done. Let's tell the people where you can be found, then we can tune out until next week. So, Danny King, where can we find you on the internet?
Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, TheKingBulletin.com, TheFilmStage.com, and HBOGo.com.
And Nick Newman.
FilmStage.com, and trying to turn my straight thoughts and, you know, darkness into humor and affability on Twitter.com/Nick_you.
You can find me on twitter.com/BrianRowan, thefilmstage.com, and my personal site dearfilm.net, as well as the darkest pits of Carcosa. So ladies and gentlemen, tune in next week and we will be talking about the Grand Budapest Hotel.